Before we get started with this episode, I want to share something that I think could be a game changer for your classroom. Now, as a former special education teacher, one of the things I struggled with the most was creating activities, resources, and curriculum for my classroom. I did not realize that that was part of my job. I have spent the last 10 years developing the Autism Helper curriculum based on what was missing from my former classroom. And now we finally have a way for school districts to purchase this curriculum directly for their teachers. The Autism Helper Curriculum Access is an annual subscription that provides access to all levels and subjects of our curriculum. This curriculum is rooted in evidence-based practices, it's aligned to the standards, and we just completed our pilot case study showing the overall effectiveness. To learn more about how your district can get curriculum access, head over to theautismhelper.com and click Curriculum Access. Hi, I'm Sasha Long, special ed teacher and board certified behavior analyst. Welcome to the Autism Helper podcast. I'm here to explore different strategies to improve the lives of individuals with autism. Welcome back to the Autism Helper podcast. Today, I'm sharing my interview with BCBA Quintara Tucker. Quintara is the voice behind the popular Instagram page, The Mystical Analyst. You probably already follow her. She is also the CEO and owner of QB Consulting. I love her perspective and mindset. I honestly could have chatted about this topic for a while because she shared so many great actionable strategies to really improve your practice, whether you are a teacher, clinician, paraprofessional, or parent collaborating with schools as well. Today, we're talking about cultural responsiveness, really what this means and how we as educators can make sure that we are providing culturally responsive strategies and interventions. If we don't, honestly, strategies don't work as well. We need that trust and rapport with families in order to create strategies that work in households, that are in line with their values and what their family believes in. And the first steps can really start through open conversations. Quintara gives a lot of great examples of things to do and really ways to make sure that you have your own cultural bias in check when looking at things like assessment and evaluations. So let's go ahead and hear from Quintara Tucker. Hi, Quintara. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Hi, Sasha. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to have you on because I feel like we're going to have a lot to chat about, and I'm very excited to cover this topic because this isn't something we've talked a ton about on the podcast.
I agree. I'm so excited to get into this today.
So today we're going to talk about cultural responsiveness. And I think this is kind of a buzz phrase, you know, that people maybe in your opinion or not use incorrectly or overuse. So in the context of autism and special education, how would you define providing culturally responsive education and clinical practice?
Yeah, totally. So I think in order to really define cultural responsiveness, we really have to stop, and think about what culture really is. As I speak about culture today with you, I'm going to be referring to anything that a group of individuals share. So to your point and to your question in the context of special education, right, those students all share the right to a free and public education, regardless of their background or any cultural aspects, right? So when I think of cultural responsiveness in this setting, I think of it being an ongoing practice of kind of understanding and honoring a student's cultural identity, values, and their lived experiences. And then again, using this understanding that we've gathered from that to inform how we then assess, teach, and then go on to support them in the classroom.
It's such an important piece that I think we don't talk about enough. We like assume it's going to happen, but when it doesn't happen, you notice big time.
Totally.
And I think for especially our students on the spectrum and families with students with special needs, this can be especially important, but also challenging. What do you see as like obviously this is important for everyone, but especially for this group, what distinction do you see here?
I think overall, the understanding that autism doesn't exist in like a vacuum is the first thing that I think we have to understand, right? Culture kind of shapes how behaviors are expressed, how we interpret them, and then how we then go on to support them, right? So without any sort of cultural responsiveness in our work or culturally responsive training, we unfortunately risk misunderstanding needs, mislabeling those behaviors, and then creating interventions that really don't align with the families that we serve or their values.
Yes, that's what I was going to, that was kind of leading into my next question. You know, when we create strategies that aren't in line with a family's cultural values, it's just, it's so ineffective because, I mean, even if families want to try it, it's just not something that is going to work for them. What are some other ways similar to that you see clinicians or teachers kind of miss the mark or have a misstep in this area that, you know, can overall affect that child?
So I think really the biggest one is just assuming that there's one way to, you know, kind of provide interventions or there's a right way to communicate, to teach, or to really parent, right? That's definitely a myth. I see a lot of clinicians overlooking family input, relying on standardized norms without any sort of cultural context, and prioritizing compliance over meaningful, culturally relevant outcomes, right? So I see that a lot in the classroom too, right? Where it's like, oh, you know, we're in school, we have to comply, we have to sit at our desk, you know, without considering some sort of culturally relevant outcome or those cultural norms.
How do you start that conversation with families? Like thinking about, you know, a newer teacher, like, okay, I hear this, but like, how do I begin those conversations with families to know what their values are rooted in?
If you've been stuck on a 6-month wait list for a psychiatrist or bouncing between online mental health sites trying to find the right medication support, Talkiatry was built for you. It's a virtual psychiatric practice that actually fits your life and your insurance. Talkiatry is a 100% online psychiatric practice that provides comprehensive evaluations, diagnoses, and ongoing medication management. Unlike therapy-only sites, Talkiatry is psychiatry. That means that you'll be seeing a medical provider who can diagnose mental health conditions and prescribe medication when appropriate. All of their over 600 clinicians are in network with major insurers, so you can use your existing insurance instead of paying monthly out-of-pocket subscriptions or those out-of-network fees. Head to talkiatry.com/Sasha and complete the short assessment to get matched with an in-network psychiatrist in just a few minutes. That's talkiatry.com/Sasha to get matched in minutes.
So something I guess I could say I have found the most success in asking the question, how is autism or special needs or special education viewed in your culture? I just come right out and I say it, and, you know, we have an open, honest conversation with families, right? As opposed to, well, how do you feel about autism, special needs, or, you know, services in that area?
Yeah, that's a really good point, because it's going to open up those doors to a lot of different conversations. And actually, when you're saying that, I was thinking back to a family I worked with who, when referring to autism, they spoke Spanish, they used the word enfermedad a lot, which is like sickness. And that and I had to like, it was hard for me to connect with because that wasn't how I viewed autism, but that was how they at that point too, in their like journey of, you know, the diagnosis process, that was how they viewed it. And like, I had to respect that for them.
Totally. I completely agree.
What are some other differences that you've seen families from diverse backgrounds, you know, view autism, this diagnosis, or either what interventions would be acceptable in their family and their culture?
So I've noticed that some families, like you just said, may not identify fully with the label or the term autism, right? Some families may prioritize independence differently. They may or may not value community, respect, interdependence. You know, there's, when we are thinking of providing services to, you know, those individuals with autism, right? We, as clinicians and teachers, we're thinking about individualized goals, right? That is the purpose of, you know, behavior analysis in that sense, right? But if we're looking at autism and special needs as a whole or as a culture, right? Some families just view it differently. Others, of course, may have stigma concerns. That's a big one. Or just overall different expectations around what therapy or behavior analysis should look like and what school should look like.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, even thinking about, like, for younger kids, how, like, play-based therapy is, yep. that, like, is like, oh, whoa, what are you doing here? This isn't what exactly. my vision was.
Yes, yes, exactly. Like, how is, you know, insurance companies approving that? You're just playing.
Yeah. Right? You know, so you mentioned independence, and actually that's something mm-hmm. I'd kind of like to dig into, because I have found, and maybe you've seen this too, sometimes a disconnect related to goals with independence, you know, across different types of families with different cultural backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And obviously independence is something I'm always so passionate about, important, you know, this is so important and pivotal for this child, but it doesn't always have the same value with families, which is okay. But how do you bridge sometimes that disconnect? You kind of see what I'm getting at a little bit?
Yes, I do. And I think when that comes up in my practice, which it does often, again, we're sitting down with the families and we're having an open and honest conversation, right? If this is the cultural norm in your household, that's great. That's not what I want to change, right? But I still want to work with you to kind of figure out some independence goals or some goals overall that would benefit the kiddo, you know, out in public. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Or, you know, out in the store, not even just at school, because I feel like as clinicians, you know, we have this home and school conflict all the time.
Yeah.
But we forget the community piece, right? So independence, I always kind of, it is very hard to do, but it's sometimes something where I have to say, well, what if you aren't around?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then we get into an open and raw conversation in that way. Of course, your approach and your, delivery is everything in this sense, but that's why it's so important to kind of build that rapport and open those, open the floor for those open-ended questions.
Yeah. I mean, you're really like part teacher, BCBA, and part like counselor, therapist, you know, like, I mean, that's such a, I remember asking that question to families that had never thought of that. Like what's mm-hmm. going to happen when you're not here anymore? And they're like, no, I'm always going to be with him. And I'm like, well, I mean, let's think you're not like, I mean, so what's that look like?
Exactly.
And that's a hard, obviously, process for any parent, but I think it's, in relation, especially to independence goals, can lead to meaningful outcomes too.
Totally.
So thinking about families that have a different background than your own, every teacher, every behavior analyst is going to work with families that have a different background than your own. It would be very unusual to not, you know, so I like that idea of like, okay, how does autism, you know, that question that you pose, what does autism mm-hmm. look like in your culture and in your background? What are some other practical ways that educators can build trust with families, learn about those cultural differences in order to provide practice and strategies that are really meaningful to everyone?
So when we're working with, you know, a new client, or, you know, we're making, say, just in our everyday life, we're making new friends or building new relationships, the first thing that we do is we kind of build a rapport, right? And that rapport looks very similar to how we would build a rapport with our parents and our families, right? So a few strategies that I tend to ensure that I am doing, or behaviors that I'm engaging in, listening. I'm always listening first, right? I'm hearing what it is you have to say before I kind of overbear you with the facts or the data or our science, right? Another big one is asking open-ended questions. So instead of saying something like, is your morning routine difficult, right? I would ask, you know, the family or the caregivers, what does your morning routine look like here at home? Right? Kind of opening the floor up for and allowing the families to share kind of, you know, what they feel is important at that, you know, for that specific topic at that time. I also avoid assumptions. So I don't always like to assume. I just come out and I ask questions. And even if I, you know, have to ask a difficult question, I always start it with, I don't mean to offend, please excuse me. That's not my intention, but I do have a question. And then, you know, I ask the question and I honor family priorities in the moment. So if we're building goals together, I'm honoring what it is that they feel as though is socially significant to their culture, to their home, to their values, etc. I always leave the open line for communication of any sort, of course, with boundaries and clinical boundaries in place, but, you know, having kind of that open door or open phone policy is what I like to call it, you know, kind of builds that trust over time. But I think most importantly, just kind of showing genuine respect. Mm-hmm. I have expertise. Yes, I went to school for this. I love this, right? But their expertise is in their child.
Yes,
it's solely about their child. So I'm never going to step on toes in that way or kind of bring in, you know, my degrees in this situation, because regardless of how many I have or how long I've been in school, when it comes to someone else's child, they know best.
Oh, I love that. And I feel like even literally saying that, like, you are the expert in your child and like, yes, I'm here to learn from you. Like, that can just immediately kind of level the playing field. Cause you know, parents come in to, especially like think of an IEP meeting. Sometimes, unfortunately, that's their second conversation with a teacher. You know, if you've got an IEP in September, you met that teacher at open house day and then you're meeting them again. And you've got six professionals sitting at a table telling you what's wrong with your kid.
Yep.
So I think giving that, some of that power back can open that door for trust. I love that.
I agree.
And listening, like, everyone's ready. I mean, like, this is like BCBA's bad rap. Yeah. We're like, we're just ready to tell you all the answers. But like, you know, holding on a minute and being like, all right, let's pause, let's listen. And I also loved the open-ended questions, and actually the example you said reminded me of something when you're like, you know, is your morning routine difficult? I thought of this family. I like this. You know how families live like rent-free in your head? Like,
yes.
I don't know where they are even anymore. But she had single mom with four kids, three on the spectrum. And I had two in my classroom. And I said, you know, if I would have asked her, are your mornings difficult? She would have been like, no, not at all. But when I asked, what do your morning routines look like? Mm-hmm. She was like, well, before any of the kids wake up, I get them all dressed and brush their teeth while they're sleeping, which I actually don't know how that even happened. Yeah. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? You get them dressed while they're sleeping? And I mean, no judgment. I don't know how else she would do it. But I was like, okay, cool. Let's work on these things then. Yep. You know, like, I can help you. Like, your one daughter's 12 and fully capable of helping. And this is great. This is a goal we can do. But if I hadn't asked it in that way, I would have had no idea she was doing that. Like,
correct.
And that's not a sustainable thing. So you can learn so much.
Yep. Just by asking. And just, again, after you ask, then you have to then listen for what it is you're being told and then go on to make those informed database decisions.
And like, I mean, you could write up a whole IEP of goals from some of those conversations.
Totally.
Let's talk about cultural bias in assessment and evaluations. There's like a lot to unpack there.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, in schools, you don't have control of what state tests you have to do. And that's like a whole maybe different conversation for another day. But thinking about assessments we have control over or don't, like, what can we do to alleviate or reduce that?
So I think bias often shows up in this area, unfortunately. And as I continue to educate myself on this topic, I'm seeing a lot of it. Bias definitely shows up in how we as clinicians and teachers interpret behavior, how we select different assessment tools, or what we define as appropriate.
Yeah.
Right. So in the classroom setting, for example, what is appropriate classroom behavior? You know what I mean? That's so subjective.
Yeah.
And that's where our biases are going to come into play. But more on the clinical side, I often, like you said, certain situations and memories just live rent-free in my head. And years ago when I was a para, almost RBT, I experienced a situation where we were working on specific assessment goals that were not culturally relevant. And I often tell this story about when one of the goals was to teach a Black child how to comb her hair. Now, this particular child always had braids or some sort of what we call in the culture protective style. So there's no brushing, right?
You're trying to comb braids.
Yeah, because it's braided up or it's in some sort of style that probably took hours to do.
And was maybe
right?
expensive too.
Yes, totally, right? So me, you know, identifying with that culture, I was able to kind of educate the team and be like, hey, I don't really think this particular goal is appropriate, but do you know what could be appropriate? Instead of teaching her how to brush her hair, how about we teach her how to wrap her hair? That way at night, she's able to preserve this protective style for longer because it is expensive. It does take a lot of time to do. And I can only imagine having, you know, special needs and sitting in a, you know, a salon chair for all that time, right?
Yeah.
So I often think of that experience when I go to do assessments or select assessment tools, because it's, again, it's not cookie cutter. It's not one size fits all, right? So that's why I do all the work that I do, right? I try to reduce this. I try to inform others and, you know, teach how to kind of interpret this in a culturally informed way, collaborate with families, and of course that ongoing self-reflection piece to really identify our own biases, because we cannot identify bias in assessment tools or in goals or in interventions if we cannot self-reflect and identify our own biases or our own cultural biases.
Yes, that's so true. And I think in some ways, sometimes the longer you're in a field too, the more disconnected you get from your own cultural biases, because you just, I don't know, like you get in a routine or in a mode or this, or you get burnt out or bitter. I don't know what the right word is there, but I found, even with myself, but even with people that have just maybe been in that same role for a while, it's like, you need a check for a minute, like a self-check to be like, no, that's not right.
Yeah, totally.
And it's effortful. It's not something that, like, if you're like, oh, I just hope I'll naturally do this. You have to purposefully do this.
Yep.
And I even think about, like, thinking culturally about developmental norms, like it relating those two. Like, if you're in special ed for so long, I always tell special ed teachers, like, go sit in a second grade gen ed class for 10 minutes.
Yes.
And, like, just to see that, like, none of those kids are sitting perfectly quiet and never getting up and whatever. Like, that's not developmentally typical to have expectations sometimes for certain children. And that could easily equate for, like, cultural norms too, if you're not getting that self-check.
Correct.
And I think being aware of it within assessments and evaluations is so critical, because that's where our goals start, our strategies start. And if we can start there, hopefully that process snowballs.
I agree, into everything that we are then doing. And then, like, the example you shared, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. If, you know, I'm able to identify my own bias, I'm able to now see bias within the classroom setting. Why am I expecting, you know, this child to sit for 6.5 hours when in reality, no child in this building is doing that?
Yeah, I know. I see waiting goals way too often.
Yeah,
waiting? Like, I don't even wait.
Exactly.
What are some other kind of concrete doable things, you know, because a lot of it can be more, I think, philosophical, but what are, like, the action steps that you recommend that if someone's listening to this, they're like, okay, you're right, I got to get better at this, level up. What's something they can start doing tomorrow?
The first thing I think is taking the time to learn and understand your student's background, right? Learn one specific meaningful thing about each student's background. Incorporate what you've learned into lessons, incorporate those cultural references during those special holidays throughout the school year. Adjusting communication style is huge, right? Sometimes we may have to translate. Sometimes we may have to call as opposed to email, right? Little things like that. And then just checking in with families about what matters most to them. Something that I do, I actually call it a cultural check-in, and I put this on all of my intake forms. So I ask families what holidays are celebrated in the home, what languages are spoken, what's important to you, et cetera. Like, just to kind of get an idea of, you know, what's important to the family, because sometimes, back to our point that we made a little early on, if we leave it in an open-ended fashion, sometimes they're more willing to share.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, just checking off a box like yes or no, or, you know, check off all the holidays that, you know, you celebrate, when in reality, there may not be the holidays that they celebrate in that specific checklist.
that's such an easy thing to do. Like a teacher could add that on their start of the year paperwork. I mean, you could do that mid-year too. I mean, it's not, you could do it whenever, but it's low effort, but could be a big result on like starting those conversations.
Totally. And getting that family input throughout the school year, right? So Ramadan is a big one.
Yeah.
That I see a lot with my families, right? If I know a student of mine and their family celebrates Ramadan, I now understand why the student may be coming in lethargic or off routine, right? Little things like that, right? Now I have a better understanding because I asked you early on, you know, what holidays do you celebrate and what values are important to you and your family?
And maybe you're not doing like an assessment or new behavior strategy that day.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, okay, I'm not observing today.
We'll chill.
Yes.
You mentioned communication styles, like texting versus email. I think that's a really good point. Within this idea of like concrete things, how do you consider language, like literally language differences, but also communication styles when working with families?
So language itself, I think, goes beyond translation. And you kind of touched on that. I think when I think of language and when I think of communication, I think of tone.
Yeah.
I think of communication style, right? Are we face-to-face? Is it phone call? Is it email? But more importantly, I think of the meaning behind the communication. My sister tells me all the time that I listen to respond and I don't listen to hear, right? So that's something that I've been working on for you know, years now, right? Especially when I'm having meaningful conversations with families. So I often ask myself, well, what does this conversation mean to me? And what is this conversation going to mean for the family long term? Because we have to understand sometimes we're communicating with others and there may not be immediate reinforcement. There may not be an immediate outcome.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're having conversations early on to prevent a situation that may occur 6 months from now. So I think a bigger thing for me is just interpreting that meaning of the conversation. I'm also being mindful of any jargon. That's a big one because again, as behavior analysts, we go through all of this schooling and all of this coursework to learn these big words to never use them again.
I know. The more removed I get from my degree, I'm like, could I even pass the exam anymore? I don't know. Don't use the word extinction to your families. Oh my God. Extinction is my like trigger word. Like, I don't know why. It just sounds so bad.
Yes. Yes. I immediately think of like something horrible.
Yeah, and something's on fire. Like, or like dinosaurs. I don't know. Like,
yes. Yes. Exactly. But I mean, aside from that, you kind of mentioned this, I'm always respecting their preferred language. So if I need a translator, I need a translator. If I need to translate documents, I'm doing that. If I need to use an interpreter, I'm going to do that also. But I also recognize that communication norms, they vary across cultures. And I think going into any form of communication or any conversation, knowing that I'm going to learn something from it, is what honestly makes the conversation more worthwhile.
Oh, I love that too. That's like a good mindset to have.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, awesome. I feel like I could chat with you forever. let's wrap up there before we go too long. Where can people go to learn more from you?
So you could find me on Instagram at The Mystical Analyst. You could also visit my website, www.qbconsulting111.com.
Awesome. We will share those in the show notes. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Awesome. Thank you again so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Autism Helper podcast. If you liked what you heard and want to hear more, hit subscribe. It would mean a lot to me if you left some feedback. Whether I'm working one-on-one with a student, doing a podcast like this one, or presenting for a PD, my goal is always to provide as much value as I can. So your feedback really helps me make sure I'm doing just that. If you have other topics you'd like me to cover, leave in the feedback or message me on social media. You can follow me at The Autism Helper on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Pinterest, or visit my website, theautismhelper.com. Thanks again for listening.
Having the right resources for your classroom is essential to making sure your classroom is running smoothly. At the Autism Helper Shop, we have all of the resources you need to make sure you have the behavior, communication, and curriculum supports for your students. Within our shop, we have adapted books, task cards, resources aligned to the VB map and the ABLES, behavior plan flowcharts, data sheets, curriculum, everything you need, whether you are an early childhood teacher or a high school teacher, we have all of the resources that will meet those students' needs. So head over to shop.theautismhelper.com to check out all of our resources.